LRS and Will Aitchison do not provide any legal advice. Listeners to this podcast and visitors to the LRS website should consult with their own lawyer for legal advice. LRS is not a law firm, and our employees are not acting as your attorney. The information contained in this podcast and on LRS.com is general legal information and should not be construed as legal advice to be applied to any specific factual situation.
This is Will Aitchison with Labor Relations Information System. I'd like to welcome you to our inaugural First Thursday podcast. We're going to release these podcasts on the first Thursday of every month, and the goal is to provide you with in-depth coverage of trends in public sector labor relations. Those trends are going to come from a wide variety of sources. We'll take a look at collective bargaining settlements, imposed contracts, arbitrated contracts. We'll take a look at court cases, whether from the Supreme Court or federal or state courts. We'll be reviewing grievance arbitration decisions and the opinions of federal labor agencies. We'll also look at economic data, like the Consumer Price Index and medical costs and a variety of different forms of economic data. In each podcast, we will be including a Q&A section. And in this, we will try to answer some questions that have been submitted to us about labor relations issues. Throughout the course of this podcast, I'll be referring to decisions from a variety of different sources. All of those decisions you'll be able to find online at our webpage, www.lris.com. Also, you'll be able to submit questions for the Q&A section of the podcast through LRIS.com. With that introduction, let's move into the meat of the first podcast. There are two developments on the national scale in the last 30 days that I think have a lot of potential significance for those of us in public sector labor relations. The first is a major decision out of the Florida Supreme Court on the issue of changes to retirement systems. This is a case that's known as Scott versus Williams, and you can find it on the Florida Supreme Court's webpage. It was a case decided in January of 2013. And here's what was going on in Scott. In 2011, the Florida legislature changed the Florida retirement system in two substantial ways. Forever, the retirement system had been non-contributory for members. Only the employers paid a retirement contribution. That was the first of the two changes, is the legislature decreed that all members from the effective date of the legislation, which was July 1, 2011, all members had to contribute 3% of their salary to the retirement system. The second change dealt with the post-retirement cost of living adjustment. The system had a 3% annual cost of living adjustment. Once again, the Florida legislature said that with the effective date of the legislation, July 1, 2011, there would be no more annual cost of living adjustment, at least for service that was accrued by employees after that date. Groups of police officers and firefighters and teachers and other public employees all filed a constitutional challenge to this legislation. And the heart of the constitutional challenge was based on what's called the Contracts Clause. These are clauses that appear in most state constitutions. They definitely appear in the federal constitution. And what the Contracts Clause says is that government cannot act in a way that impairs an existing contract. The argument that the employees made in the Florida Supreme Court was that this retirement legislation did impair their contract. The argument was we took our jobs under certain conditions, certain assumptions as to what our retirement benefits were going to be, and now after we've put in some amount of time working, a year, 10 years, 30 years, you are changing the rules under which we are going to be compensated through our retirement benefits, and that is a unilateral alteration of a contract. That's what the argument was. The Florida Supreme Court rejected that argument. The court found that because the legislation only applied prospectively to service after July 1, 2011, and did not attempt to impact service prior to that date, it didn't impair a contract. The court didn't come right out and say this, but I think it's a fair reading of the court's rationale that the court was telling the employees, look, you can make a decision after July 1, 2011 as to whether you want to continue in that contract with the employer. If you don't, if you leave, your benefits prior to that date won't be impacted. This legislation is prospective only. And I'm not going to read a lot of the court's opinion. I just want to read you a couple of sentences that give you a feel for where the court was coming from with respect to this decision. The court wrote, we hold that the preservation of rights statute, that has to do with the preservation of contractual and retirement rights, was not intended to bind future legislatures from prospectively altering benefits for future service performed by all members of this system. The preservation of rights statute does not create binding contract rights for existing employees to future retirement benefits based on the system's plan that was in place prior to July 1, 2011. So what does this mean for existing employees in Florida? Say you're on a system where you have a 25-year retirement and you've put in 17 years. Well, it looks like what it means is that once you retire at 25 years of service, you will be entitled to that old 3% cost of living adjustment on your retirement, but only for 17/25 of your retirement benefit. In other words, only for the 17 years that occurred prior to July 1, 2011. For the 8 years it took you to complete your service and get to retirement, you would not get a cost of living adjustment on that percentage of your retirement. One final note is, I think, very important about this case. Other courts in other states may well see this differently. We can think of several states where state Supreme Court rulings look at the issue quite differently. They look at when the employee's contract rights vest, and the date of vesting depends upon how your particular retirement system is written, but a typical vesting date is that retirement vests with 5 years of service. Once you vest, these other courts would say, the benefit may not be altered, and in particular, the post-retirement cost of living benefit can't be altered. The rationale of those courts is that employees have foregone career opportunities by making the decision to stay the job and staying through the vesting period, and thus there should be no ability to alter that basic contract. The second of the developments that has a national impact isn't case law. It comes to us from the Department of Labor. The Department of Labor is the federal agency that has the responsibility of interpreting the Family and Medical Leave Act. And from time to time, the Department of Labor issues what it calls a guidance or an administrator's interpretation. This one has the number of 2013-1. And what this guidance deals with is a question that many of us have wondered about, but we've never had a definitive answer on before, which is what are the circumstances under which a parent may take Family and Medical Leave Act to care for a child with a serious health condition? And by child, as we move the question a little bit further, does that mean adult children? And there hasn't been a real clear answer to that. The Department of Labor's guidance gives us that answer and says, look, so long as the employee is caring for a child of whatever age and four tests are met, then the employee is entitled to use Family and Medical Leave Act in order to care for the child. What are the four tests? First of all, the adult or the child, whether adult or a child, must meet the test for having a disability under the Americans with Disabilities Act. And that relates the FMLA and the ADA in a way that heretofore those two statutes haven't really been very tightly knit. And as many of you know, we are now dealing with a very expanded definition of disability under the Americans with Disabilities Act, courtesy of changes that came to us in 2008 from Congress. And it's fairly easy to qualify for having a disability. Well, that's the first of the four tests. The second is that the child must be incapable of self-care. What does that mean? That means the Department of Labor tells us that the child must require assistance in completing three or more activities of daily living or instrumental activities of daily living. Well, what are those? The Department of Labor has given us examples. Activities of daily living, including caring for one's grooming and hygiene, bathing, dressing, and eating. So basics, the basic stuff of life, if you will. Instrumental activities of daily living include things that we do during the course of the day. Things like cooking, cleaning, shopping, taking public transportation, paying bills, using telephones, using a post office. All of those are examples that the Department of Labor has given us. So back to our four-part test. Test one, the child must meet the standards for a disability under the ADA. Test two, the child must be incapable of self-care. Test three, the child must have a serious health condition as defined by the Family and Medical Leave Act. Basically, that means is absent from work or school for more than 3 days, some other tests, but that's the most basic one. And fourth, the child must need the care due to the serious health condition. Perhaps most importantly in this four-part definition is the Department of Labor has told us that the age of onset of the health condition for the child is irrelevant as to whether or not the child is covered. What's important is that the four criteria are satisfied. You can find this guidance on the Department of Labor's webpage. And again, the reference to it is Administrator's Interpretation 2013-1. We are seeing the continuation of a slight uptick in total compensation settlements across the country. We started to see this uptake, I think, in the latter part of 2011, the early part of 2012, and we are seeing that continue in many jurisdictions. Now, I'm talking, of course, very average numbers. There are settlements that are greater than that. There are settlements that are less than that. But on the average, I think we can expect to see changes in total compensation in the range of 1-2% on a national basis. And now, there's a very notable exception, a very poignant resolution of contract negotiations that just happened that has really made an awful lot of a splash in the news. So I want to spend a little bit of time going over it. This is one of the cities in the country that's going through the bankruptcy process. This is San Bernardino, California. San Bernardino sought bankruptcy protection last year, and a variety of causes of the of San Bernardino seeking bankruptcy protection, oddly enough, not too many people list wages, benefits, or pension contributions as among the major causes. More financial mismanagement is what folks point to in the San Bernardino situation. The impact on wages and benefits, though, is very serious and very marked. San Bernardino bargains under a meet and confer system. And that means that at the end of the bargaining process, if there's no agreement between unions and management, the employer is free to unilaterally impose its last best offer. And that, in fact, is what the San Bernardino City Council did last week. By a 4-3 margin, it imposed a contract resolution that represents a 14% reduction in total compensation. 14% cut in total compensation. It was imposed on police and fire. The city was able to negotiate agreements that had roughly the same terms with some of its other unions. The form was not a reduction in wages. It was more a increase in retirement contributions and also an end to the city's practice of paying the 9% retirement contribution for on behalf of employees. The net effect, though, on employees is going to be, because of the tax treatment of the retirement, is actually going to be probably around a 15% reduction in pay. Once again, this is an outlier type settlement. It's balanced by other settlements around the country. We detail those in our newsletter. We have a table of settlements from around the country, and we are definitely seeing trends that seem to be holding very steady of around 1-2% increase in wages. Let's now turn to some decisions from courts and arbitrators that have come down in the last 30 days that have some significance. The first one I want to point to is actually a little bit older than that, but it's just has only been recently published. This is a decision from late in 2012, and it's a case from Ohio State Employment Relations Board. The case name is Williams County Sheriff's Office. And you can find this on the webpage for Ohio State Employment Relations Board. And it is case number 2011-ULP-12. And this is, I think, a pretty important case about a last chance agreement and the role of a union in a last chance agreement. Let's start with the question of what a last chance agreement is. Typically with a last chance agreement, you have an employee who has displayed a disciplinary problem over the years, such that the employer has imposed progressive discipline and finally is in a position, because of the most recent misconduct by the employee, to actually terminate the employee. The employer doesn't want to terminate the employee for whatever reason, and instead tells the employee, okay, this is it. This is your last chance. You'll accept a long suspension now, and you'll agree that for a period of time, 2 years, 3 years, 5 years, whatever, if you have any other similar disciplinary process problems, you can be terminated. This is your last chance. And you'll also agree you won't have access to the grievance procedure. That's what a last chance agreement is. They tend to be pretty effective management tools. In the years that I've been practicing, I've been involved in any of a number of last chance agreements. What I have never seen is the employee fail. They have always seemed to work to get the employee's attention and to correct the pattern of misbehavior. So what happens in this Ohio case? Well, this involves a deputy sheriff, a couple of them. One's name is Michelle Zinman, or Zimmon. The other is a deputy named Ken Jacobs. And they're having sort of a water cooler combination or conversation. And in this conversation, Deputy Jacobs dares Zimmon to send him, to email him, a topless photograph of herself. Zimmon ends up thinking this is a pretty good idea and sends him the photograph, takes a photograph, and sends it to his personal email. Unfortunately for everybody concerned, Jacob's wife, Amanda Jacob, a dispatcher with the sheriff's office or with the Williams County Communications Center, which is co-housed with the sheriff's office, Mrs. Jacobs sees the photograph. She promptly reports to the sheriff what has been going on, and the sheriff believes this to be a matter of the highest priority. in the description we see from the SERB, the sheriff pretty much drops everything, conducts an immediate investigation, and within a matter of days, decides that he has just cause to fire Zimmon. What he does is to call for a meeting with his second-in-command, Zimmon, and Zimmon's union representative. The sheriff starts off the meeting by telling the union rep and Zimmon that he's making a one-time offer, and that one-time offer is a last-chance agreement. Zimmon is going to have to agree to a fairly lengthy suspension and agree that she'll be terminated if there's any future misconduct of a similar nature, and that she won't access the grievance procedure. The union representative says, wait a minute, time out, can I fax this last chance agreement to the union's lawyer? And the sheriff says, no, you can't. So the union rep leaves the room and makes phone call to the lawyer, and in the meantime, the sheriff and Zimmon have a conversation. And that conversation, out of the presence of the union rep, ends up with Zimmon signing the last chance agreement. The union then files an unfair labor practice complaint saying, look, two things. First of all, you ended up negotiating a last chance agreement without our presence. That's an unfair labor practice. And secondly, you interfered with our ability to choose our representative to handle this problem. We wanted our lawyer to handle this problem. And the board agrees with the union on both counts. Now, the first half of the board's decision is not very revolutionary. We've known for years, cases from all over the country, that because last chance agreements impact discipline, that the union has to be a party to a last chance agreement. If there is to be an agreement about a mandatory subject of bargaining, and discipline is a mandatory subject of bargaining, the union has to be party to that agreement for it to be enforceable. Otherwise, what the employer is doing is undercutting the union's status as the exclusive bargaining representative for employees. So the board's holding that the sheriff committed an unfair labor practice by negotiating directly with Zimmon over the terms of this last chance agreement, that really isn't much of a significant holding in terms of breaking new ground. It's the second half of the case that's important. Because what the board ends up saying is that because the sheriff didn't provide notice to the union of the purpose of the meeting, that the sheriff actually interfered with the union's right to representation under the Weingarten rule. And the way the board looked at this was to say many things could have happened from that meeting. The meeting could have been simply a meeting to notify Zimmon and her union rep of the status of the investigation, or perhaps that there was no discipline. The possibility of a last chance agreement is only one of the things that could have happened, but one thing that is apparent, one thing that any reasonable party should know, says the board, is that if this is about a last chance agreement, the union's going to treat that with the utmost of seriousness. And that means, says the board, if you, the employer, are planning a meeting of that degree of seriousness, you have an obligation to let the union know in advance what the purpose of the meeting is, so that the union can choose the representative who it believes will be the most effective under the circumstance. Interesting ruling. I do not recall ever seeing a decision like this before where there has been a requirement for advance notice of the purpose of a meeting so that the union can more appropriately exercise its Weingarten rights. Well, let's move from Ohio, next door, over to Chicago. And the long-running and ever-fascinating Chicago BlackBerry case is picking up some steam. This is a Fair Labor Standards Act lawsuit filed by a Chicago police sergeant. And what his claim is, look, when you send us home, those of us who are employees in the Bureau of Organized Crime, you give us BlackBerries and your unwritten code has us constantly working on those BlackBerries, making phone calls on the BlackBerries, composing and reading email on the BlackBerries, doing file handling on the BlackBerries, all of those sorts of things. This case is still in the early pretrial stages, but from the standpoint of the plaintiffs, crossed a very important threshold last month. And that threshold is that the judge granted a motion to treat this as a class action, or as class actions are called under the Fair Labor Standards Act, a collective action. What the court ends up holding is that there's enough evidence to conclude that the employees in the Organized Crime Bureau are similarly situated. In other words, there was an evidence that without regard to what the employer's written rules said, there was enough evidence of a past practice where employees were expected to perform this work off the clock to justify treating the case as a collective action. Even though that was bad news for the employer, the judge did have some comments at the end of his opinion indicating he may not be all that sanguine about the merits of the case individually. I'll read to you a couple of lines from the judge's opinion, and you'll see what I mean. The judge closes with, despite Allen, that's the sergeant who brought the case, despite Allen's ability to survive the collective action question, we reiterate our questions about the ability to treat on a class basis the broad range of situations in which police personnel may respond to messages that are sent to them on PDAs, the extent to which those responses might constitute work, and the extent to which any work might not be compensable because it's de minimis or too small. So even though the plaintiffs crossed an important hurdle with the Allen case, they've still got a more important hurdle to cross, which is they have to show that once they get down to the merits of the case and putting on their case on a plaintiff-by-plaintiff basis, that it is still appropriate to treat the case on a collective basis. Now let's move from Chicago over to New Jersey, where we run into a pretty anomalous court case. And this is a case where the court actually overturns an arbitrator's opinion. That doesn't happen often. So much deference is given to arbitrators' opinions and the notions that arbitrators' opinions are final and binding that it's very, very rare to see a court opinion overturning an arbitrator's decision. I would guess that it happens less than 5% of the time based on the cases that I've looked at. This is a case involving Local 249 of the Police Benevolent Association of New Jersey. It has a contract with Burlington County, New Jersey, and the sheriff's office there. And that contract has a sick leave clause. And in the sick leave clause, the jail administrator is given the ability to demand a doctor's note if the jail administrator reasonably suspects the employee of abusing sick leave. So pretty standard clause you see in a collective bargaining agreement on the abuse of sick leave and a doctor's note requirement. This is a case that involves corrections officers Ralph West. And West applied for and originally got approval to take family leave for his son, to take care of his son. Son suffers from sickle cell anemia and has a variety of intermittent health conditions, some of which are quite serious. His son, for example, has suffered from strokes. In 2010, the county decided that West had used sick leave so much that he and a number of other employees had to submit proof of illness after each sick leave usage, including each day of sick leave usage. Eventually, West fails to do so, and he is docked 8 hours of pay for failing to produce the doctor's note, with the county, of course, citing the clause in the collective bargaining agreement on the doctor's note. An arbitrator ends up upholding the county's decision, finds that the county could legitimately treat West as a suspected sick leave abuser just because of the frequency of the use of his sick leave. Mind you now, no one actually thought that West was abusing sick leave. No one thought that he was making up the condition that his son had or exaggerating it or taking advantage of it in any way. It's just that West hit a numerical threshold that after which everybody in that category got treated as a suspected sick leave abuser. And that, said a New Jersey appeals court, was the problem. That's why the arbitrator's opinion had to be overturned. What the court ends up finding is that the FMLA allows an employee to take intermittent leave whenever it's medically necessary to do so. The court pointed to the fact that West applied for and received permission to use family leave due to his son's medical condition, and that that was based on a doctor's certification. And that requiring a sick leave note or a doctor's note on each occasion after that, in the words of the court, interferes with the exercise of FMLA rights, especially where, as here, there is no evidence of prior abuse of intermittent leave involving West's son. So the court ends up overturning the arbitrator's opinion, concluding that the opinion violated public policy because it violated the Family and Medical Leave Act. One of the regular features that we intend to have in our first Thursday podcast is a review of what labor boards and courts think of as mandatory subjects of bargaining. Sometimes these are called scope of bargaining cases, and the implications are these. If whatever it is thought to be a mandatory subject of bargaining, then the employer has to bargain over that, either if the union makes a proposal on the topic or if the employer makes a proposal on the topic. The union has to bargain about it. Perhaps just as importantly, if not more importantly, if something is mandatory for bargaining, the employer is not free to make a change in past practice in the area, unless the employer first bargains with the labor organization. Of course, the union can always waive the right to bargain over a change in past practice. But the general proposition is if something's mandatory for bargaining, the employer's got to bargain about it. So let's go over a few cases that have been recently decided on the area of past practice, and let's talk about what the rationale of these labor boards might be. And let's start with some police cases, and I'll start with one that I think is a pretty straightforward case. It comes out of Washington's Public Employment Relations Commission and the City of Tacoma. What was the past practice here? The past practice was that on-duty police officers would be allowed to participate in a charity basketball game. And the employer decided that that should no longer be the case, that officers who wanted to participate in this basketball game would have to take leave in order to play in the game. Washington's Public Employment Relations Commission thought that was a mandatory subject of bargaining, that the employer wasn't free to make that change, had to rescind the past practice and make employees whole. Why would playing in a basketball game be a mandatory subject of bargaining? Well, that's one way of phrasing it. Another way of phrasing it is, why would the compensation that employees receive for a portion of their workday be a mandatory subject of bargaining? And that's how Washington's PERC saw the issue. They saw it as a wage issue. Look, you're talking about whether or not someone is paid for an activity that occurs during their workday or whether they have to take leave. That is a wage issue, and thus that is a topic that is mandatory for bargaining. Let's turn to a case from the city of Philadelphia. This is one of a series of cases that has come to us from Pennsylvania on the issue of subcontracting. And what is subcontracting for labor relations purposes? Subcontracting is the transfer or assignment of what is or should be bargaining unit work to non-bargaining unit personnel. Subcontracting can be hiring an outside contractor to do the work, or subcontracting can be assigning the work to some non-bargaining unit employees. They could be non-union employees, they could be management, they could be employees in another bargaining unit. So long as the work has historically been performed by the bargaining unit in question, constitutes subcontracting. The assignment of that work elsewhere constitutes subcontracting. So what's our Philadelphia case about? This is a case where the employer, the city of Philadelphia, unilaterally reassigns the work of transporting prisoners from holding cells to different city locations, transfers that work from deputy sheriffs to civilian court employees. This is done as a cost-saving measure, and we see this sort of civilianization occurring in a lot of places. Not a lot of long-term studies, by the way, as to whether or not there are cost savings from civilianization of this sort, but nonetheless, there's a widespread perception that there is cost saving. Well, an administrative law judge with Pennsylvania's Labor Relations Board found that this was subcontracting, that this impacted the mandatory subject of bargaining of wages and also of job security, and found that there was a consistent past practice of deputy sheriffs doing this work, and thus ruled that the employer violated the collective bargaining law by assigning that work to non-deputy sheriffs, assigning it to civilians. What's the usual remedy in these cases? The usual remedy is what you can think of as a make-whole remedy, meaning that the employer is required to compensate employees in the bargaining unit as if they had performed the work in question. Lastly, let's move to a firefighter case. This is another case out of Washington, from Washington's Public Employment Relations Commission. This was decided just a couple of weeks ago. And this is a question whether a proposal concerning an unusual aspect of the grievance procedure is a mandatory subject of bargaining. And this is a case that comes out of the King County Fire District, King County Fire District 34. And here's what goes on in this case. The existing contract has a grievance procedure that culminates with binding arbitration. And there's a clause in the arbitration section of the agreement that requires each party to bear its own attorney's fees in arbitration. And the employer wants to continue that language. And the union is thinking of getting rid of that language. Why would a union want to have, in essence, a loser pay clause on attorney's fees? What would be the rationale? Well, the rationale, I'm pretty sure, is that unions typically, more often than not, win in arbitration. Why do unions win? Is it that arbitrators are pro-union? No, unions win because they get to pick the cases that go to arbitration. And unions typically don't refer many cases to arbitration. They drop cases that they don't believe are sufficiently meritorious to warrant arbitration. So on the average, when you look at labor arbitration in this country over the last 60 to 70 years, you see unions winning fairly significant majority of cases in arbitration. So that's, I'm guessing, what the union in King County is up to here by proposing in essence, contemplating going to a loser pays clause on whether or not attorney's fees should be borne by the losing party or borne equally. What does Washington Perks say about this case? It says that since this is a proposal related to the grievance procedure, all aspects of this proposal are mandatory for bargaining. That means either management's position that it the expenses of attorneys should be borne by each side, or the union's position, potential position, that you'd go to loser pays for attorney's fees. Both of those are mandatory for bargaining. And if you can't reach an agreement on them, well, then they're going to have to be directed to, or the dispute will have to be directed to binding arbitration, where an arbitrator will decide the issue. How's an arbitrator likely to rule on that issue? Arbitrators, I found, are very loath to award attorney's fees. They think that punishes one party or the other too much, and it's an extraordinarily rare case where you see an arbitrator awarding attorney's fees. Arbitrators don't even particularly like loser pays clauses with respect to their own bills. So I would anticipate, if there's no agreement on this issue, that whoever is going to be arguing for loser pays on arbitration fees is going to have a pretty tough road to hoe. Let's turn now to a couple of questions and answers that we received over the course of the last month. Now, here's the first question, and this comes to us out of New York. And the question is, our district attorney has decided that one of our detectives violated a suspect's Sixth Amendment rights and that he must now notify any defense attorney for cases involving this detective under the Brady Rule or Giglio versus United States of his belief about the detective's violation of the Sixth Amendment rights. Do you have any guidance on when the Brady Rule applies and if the DA can simply make this determination without a hearing or proceeding? The question ends by saying, we feel the detective should have some legal recourse to clear his name. Now, here's our assessment of this situation. And first of all, this is not unique. We're seeing this all around the country, kind of the expansion of the Brady Rule and concerns about the Brady Rule around the country. It's really started in Los Angeles, in the Los Angeles County District Attorney's Office, and it's very slowly been spreading over the course of the last 8 to 10 years, so that you're encountering these sorts of questions all over the country. There's a little bit of a surprise that we have about this district attorney. And the surprise is that the trigger here is the violation of a suspect's Sixth Amendment rights. What you'd expect to see for Brady status, Brady notification, is a legitimate belief that the officer has been dishonest and that there are questions of truthfulness that need to be disclosed to the defense as part of the general obligation that prosecutors have to disclose all exculpatory and inculpatory information to the defense. A Sixth Amendment violation isn't an untruthfulness problem. So we're a little bit surprised to see that. But let's assume that there's an adequate basis for the DA to do something here, that there's something that this detective did that violated a suspect's rights. What about the fact that there's been no hearing and the DA apparently doesn't intend to give the deputy a hearing? Does that violate any constitutional rights? And our answer is, we don't think so. I've seen a lot of cases from around the country on Brady rights where officers have tried a variety of different legal theories. You can check, for example, in the January issue of our publication, Public Safety Labor News, we had an article entitled, Brady Alert System Does Not Violate Officers' Equal Protection Rights, where only some, but not all officers who had a particular offense were put onto a DA's Brady list. All of the challenges we've seen to the actions of a district attorney have been unsuccessful. Now, that does not mean that an employer must or is even necessarily free to terminate an employee who has been placed on a Brady list. In fact, there are some arbitrators' decisions saying that an employer is not free to do so. In essence, has to find light-duty work that doesn't involve testimony in court until the storm blows over. And if that storm doesn't blow over, perhaps even find that work for the rest of the officer's career. There are arbitrators' decisions going the other way, saying that if you can't testify in court, you've basically shown that you're not able to do the essential functions of the job of a police officer. So the jury's out with respect to an employer's obligation under these circumstances. I'll tell you a trend we've seen, and that is the less in the way of something that remotely approaches due process you see from the district attorney, the more inclined an arbitrator is to tell an employer, look, you've got to hang on to this employee. So there's actually an advantage that employers get by intervening with their district attorney to make sure that there's a full hearing on the allegations of potential untruthfulness. Our second question and answer that we want to take a look at comes from California, and it's a pretty straightforward question, and here it is. I've been researching a court settlement for the County of Los Angeles Fire Department where an employee won a decision on an FLSA issue for back pay overtime for the hour that he or she arrived early to work each shift. My understanding is that the FLSA accounts for this turnover time, but the employee had some performance evaluation documents that stated he or she arrived early to work. Are we familiar with this case? Where can we find it? And is this accurate under the FLSA? All right, well, let's talk about this issue in the fire service, and then I'll talk about the Los Angeles County situation. You often see this called early relief in the fire service, and it happens in policing, it happens in other public sector jobs, where, let's say, a shift start time is 8 a.m., you have some employees who come in early, say it's 7 a.m. in the example given in this question, and they come in early basically so that there's a transition team and you don't have a break in service to the public. Well, so long as those same employees are left let go an hour early at the end of their shifts, there's no FLSA problem because they're working the same amount of time on their normal shifts that you would see if they had their regular start time. Where employers get into problem with early relief is if you have this set of employees that comes in early, and then toward the end of their shift, there is some sort of call for service that requires large-scale mobilization, such that those employees end up working to the normal ending time of the shift. In other words, they work an extra hour because they come in early. The employer's got to take that extra hour in account and figuring out whether the employee is entitled to overtime under the Fair Labor Standards Act. That's work, and it's no less work because it occurs at the end of the shift. It's the same quality and nature of work that is done during the course of the normal shift. So I think the right FLSA analysis in this sort of situation is that hour coming in early is considered work. It's no problem under the FLSA as long as the employee goes home an hour early. But if the employee doesn't go home an hour early, the employer could be in trouble unless it compensates the employee for that last hour. So what about the Los Angeles County situation? Actually, we've done some searching on that, searching both through a legal research database and also just doing some Google searches. And we can't find any case law or any description of this occurring in Los Angeles County. Doesn't mean it didn't, because sometimes it's very difficult to find these sorts of settlements. We just simply can't track it down. The settlement that is described in this question makes a good deal of sense to us under the FLSA. If the employer is writing down in performance evaluations, we think this employee did a good job because he comes in early to work, that could hardly be more of a smoking gun that the employer is, in FLSA parlance, suffering and permitting the employee to work. All right, let's close this podcast the way we'll close all of them, with some economic figures and take a look at some important numbers. This podcast, the only numbers we're going to cover are the most recent consumer price index figures. As we move through these podcasts, we'll talk from time to time about economic projections and an important economic indicators like employment and housing starts and things like that. But for the purposes of this first podcast, let's just take a look at what the CPI is doing. And the CPI is increasing at a very modest rate. The most recent CPI figures, as of the recording of this podcast, come from January 2013. They show on a national basis the CPI increasing at 1.7% per year. It's a little bit higher in the Northeast and Midwest, where it's 1.8% a year, a little bit lower in the South and West, where it's 1.6% per year, but we're under what I think most economists have anticipated, which is a 2% increase in the CPI. What's going on with medical costs over that same yearly period of time? National medical component of the CPI increasing at double the rate of the CPI, 3.4%. That's actually an incredibly moderate increase of health insurance costs. Or health care costs. We have been seeing, as recently as within the last year, double-digit numbers, and so seeing a 3.4% increase in medical costs gives us a little bit of a ray of sunshine for those of us, whether we represent management or labor, who are bargaining over health insurance issues at the table. And with that, we conclude our first Thursday. Thanks for joining us.